Hi, I'm Piper.
And I'm Erin.
Welcome to Off the Tracks podcast, where we explore what it means to do law differently.
Today, we are joined by Aladdin Tingling Diakun. Aladdin is a certified executive coach for New Planet Professionals, a corporate lawyer for impact-focused small and mid-sized enterprises, and a circular economy board chair with nearly two decades of experience in climate and sustainability. We are so excited to have him on the show today.
So we were all just sitting here chatting and I was like, hey guys, we have to hit record because we could just sit here and chat and talk about everything under the sun all day. We are so excited to have Aladdin here. I've had the opportunity to speak with Aladdin before, and Erin and Aladdin were just having a great time getting to know each other as well. And we're so excited for all of you, if you haven't met Aladdin before, to get to know him through this episode. So Aladdin, we'd love to hear in your own words a little bit about how your career has evolved over time.
Sure. Thanks, Piper and Erin, for having me on, first of all. It's a total treat to be here. So my career has not been, it's definitely gone all over the place, I think, in retrospect. I started out in nonprofit work. So I got a job at Greenpeace back around 2004. I was doing fundraising, standing out on the street with a binder, asking people to give me their credit card information. Hilariously, in those times, or hilarious to me now, I used to say, we'd occasionally canvas around sort of King and Bay downtown. Toronto would be one of the places we'd go. And I used to swear to myself that I'd never become one of those lawyers or, other sort of downtown types walking around in a suit. So joke's on me, because I did become that person for a while. So I did that. I worked at Greenpeace in a few capacities for about 5 years in fundraising and communications and research in advocacy. I did some fun Greenpeace-y things, of course, as well. And then I went back to school. I had been out of school for a few years. I went back, figured I should finish my degree. I had kind of hit what felt like an employment ceiling at the time. I was having trouble landing a permanent contract, which will be a theme in my career. And I was interested in other things. So I went back to school. I did a poli-sci. I finished my first degree, which was in Hispanic studies, is what it ended up being. And I did a second undergrad in political science because I wanted to do a master's, and I didn't think my grades were going to be good enough. So a lot of time in school, went off and did a master's in global governance at a place called the Balsillie School of International Affairs in Waterloo. And my focus at that time was on the relationship between big planetary changes, climate change in particular, and international security and other global trends and how they sort of interact. So that was gloomy but fun and interesting, and I thought about doing my PhD, came out, didn't like the look of the academic job market, and I thought, well, I've got all of this cool nonprofit experience and I've got this fun academic experience. Who wouldn't want to hire me now in the private sector? I am smart and have things to offer. So off I went to be rapidly disabused of that notion, and I was applying at that time for jobs in sort of ESG, such as it was at the time. This was sort of 2014. And I was interested in also things like different types of risk analysis, political risk analysis, climate risk, scenario planning, and couldn't quite seal the deal on the type of thing that I would want. And I was to be fair, I was, I had a lot going on. I'd sort of run out of money from my grad funding and another recurring theme. And I had some sort of stuff going on the home front. So I moved back home to help out my family at home. But that also meant that I was sleeping on my parents' couch and kind of in the living room / kitchen of their condo. And my grandmother was living there at the time. And my brother was a little, younger brother was finishing high school. And there was a lot going on. And I was trying to finish my master's still too. So it was stressful and I was pretty discouraged. And I thought, this is not a succinct telling of the story at all, but I'll try to get through to the law part. So, So I got pretty discouraged. I was doing a few things. I was teaching ESL. I was doing sort of some odd academic work here and there. But again, really, I mean, I didn't have $5 to, you know, go have a coffee with my friends. It was really discouraging and isolating and frustrating. And so, like any elder millennial, what do? I decide to go back to the old education casino for one more kick of the can and apply to law school, thinking, hey, if I don't have something better going on a year from now, I want to have some option of what I'm going to be doing, you know, with my life. So I applied, signed up for the LSAT, started studying, and, you know, as happens, it sort of just took over then the whole admissions cycle. And so I got into law school and off I went. And those were not my favorite years of my life or career. Very, very tough. Some great things that came out of it, certainly, not the least of which was meeting my my partner. But so I kind of joke that it was just like a very, very, very expensive dating service going off to law school. Came out, I was sort of funneled into the big law Bay Street jam, and had summered at a big firm, articled at a big firm, was not hired back at that big firm. And that this was May of 2020, end of May 2021, when I finished my articles. So, you know, it was sort of the Tiger King era of the pandemic. Very tough, you know, tough time then not being hired back, not knowing what I was doing. And so I found myself having to reinvent myself a little bit, reinvent my, you know, figure out how am I going to relate to the law now? How does all of this climate and sustainability stuff I used to do fit in? And where do I want to go next? And how can I be really intentional about the life and career that I'm building? And centering wellness really is a piece of that too, because I was profoundly burnt out. So that's like the medium length version of the story. Sorry, let me hand it back to you now. And, you know, ask away any questions. Where do you want to go next?
Well, first of all, I really enjoy the idea that law school was just like an expensive dating service. So I'm going to steal that joke, because I also found my partner through law school. But I think that's really funny. So steal that. But just as you mentioned there, now you sort of went into law and you were trying to weave in all of your climate advocacy. And so we would love to know a bit more about that, because we know you're deeply involved in climate justice advocacy and board work. So can you tell us a bit more about your work with Impact Zero and Lawyers for Climate Justice?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I'd be happy to. So May 2020, I finished articling and I think, what am I going to do now? You know, I was so burnt out at that point that I didn't know if I could even practice law. And that was a grim thought, because I'd just gone to a lot of trouble to get licensed gone into quite a significant amount of debt to get licensed. And it was a real crisis. And in a sense that I think a lot of people were going through some version of that at that time. And I was listening to another episode of your show, and somebody was talking about, I'm going to completely paraphrase it because I don't remember exactly the conversation, but the idea of, you know, the value of sort of stillness and stepping back and having a context shift in order to get some clarity. And I think a lot of us had some sort of, you know, a really big context shift in 2020, 2021. And that was true for me too. So that's a big part of what led me into working with Impact Zero and Lawyers for Climate Justice. I was trying to heal my mind and my body and my nervous system from the unrelenting stress and pressure and everything of law school and articling, and what my relationship with that experience had been. And part of that healing was about trying to reconnect with parts of my personal and professional identity that I had felt like I had had to sort of put down without really planning to, without realizing that that was going to be demanded of me. And it felt really, it felt like a severance. I don't know if either of you have seen that show. Parker, you're nodding.
Yes.
I just feel like it's like every lawyer should watch it. It's so great. And that it felt like I had inadvertently severed myself and my identity over the course of law school and articling. And that felt really like, I don't know how else to describe it other than like a violence against myself. Like it was really painful to feel alienated from all of these other parts of myself that I had valued so much and that I'd worked so hard on, put so much time and energy into, and I didn't know how to get back. I just wanted a bridge back to, to some of these parts. And so, so I started looking for opportunities to do that. And again, I didn't know if I could practice law. So it's very common, people don't get hired back. Well, I'll just go apply to another firm. And I just couldn't fathom doing that and starting over at another place and putting myself back into that type of environment. I probably would have ended up in the hospital, frankly, if I'd tried to. So board work and volunteer work became a great way for me to sort of keep a foot in the waters of the profession, but on my own terms while I, figured a bunch of things out and really worked on my health. So Lawyers for Climate Justice came along. A good friend of mine, Meredith James, somebody I had known when I was at Greenpeace, and she was involved with the Sierra Club and Sierra Youth Council at that time, and some other initiatives. And she had subsequently gone on, worked in big law, become an environmental lawyer, done other things, and was involved in this group, Lawyers for Climate Justice, which at that time was trying to engage the CBA around this idea of climate justice, this idea of climate competence, the notion that lawyers across Canada and every practice area, really have a stake in thinking about the climate crisis, and not just in the sense that it's important and it's a moral imperative and it affects all of us, but in the sense that it matters for our clients, it matters for the rule of law. It matters for even the places, the physical locations where we do law type things, and where people interact with the law. I'm thinking particularly of prison infrastructure as one great example of this, and that it has a bearing. I would argue, and others would argue that it has a real bearing on our ethical duties as lawyers as well. So Lawyers for Climate Justice, or L4CJ, was trying to running this campaign to get the CBA to adopt this climate resolution, which other jurisdictions have done similar things. And the CBA actually had a climate resolution from like a decade ago or something. So this was trying, to be the next step. So I got involved to sort of be part of that campaign, support that campaign. And then we ended up doing a bunch of other things since then, a bunch of interesting sort of internal conversations around climate competency, trying to sort of be a bit of a resource hub for thinking in this space. Meredith in particular has been doing some great work and outreach around the ethics part of the conversation and how our ethical and professional responsibilities interact with this changing climate. We did some we had like an open letter to the Prime Minister and the AG in the context of the last federal election, around again just bringing a climate lens and a climate justice lens in particular to ideally every legislative agenda, sort of what we were calling for. So that's the Lawyers for Climate Justice piece. And then Impact Zero, I was looking, had been sort of looking for a board opportunity that would be aligned for me. And, being a board director, the appeal was partly about, okay, I can sort of wear my lawyer hat you know, bring that expertise to the table without the pressure of being in private practice, and you know, work through some of my you know, my workplace trauma. So so Impact Zero is a not-for-profit based in Toronto, was founded early in the pandemic by a great leader, Aaron Andrews. And the circular economy is all about going from a linear business model, the linear production model, where you sort of take raw materials and you make something, and then the end of the story is waste. And, you know, that waste is going into any number of places, going into a landfill, going into the ocean, going into the atmosphere, going into, you know, a poor racialized community, you know, here or elsewhere. But at the end of the day, it's going into waste. And the circular economy is a whole bunch of sort of conversations and frameworks and ways of thinking about, well, how can we not do that? How can we do that differently in a way that saves money and you know, gives consumers more options and is better as a matter of equity and so on. So Impact Zero is trying to be a big part of that conversation in Canada by empowering people to bring those types of solutions to life. We've had accelerator programs that we've run. We've got a circular business directory. So I joined the board to support those efforts and then was subsequently asked to chair the board about a year ago, which I've been doing since then.
Okay, so Aladdin, when we were chatting before we started recording the podcast and we were kind of like, you know, just talking about all the things you're involved in, and I mentioned that I was like a little bit nervous to have this conversation because I feel like right. I don't know enough about climate justice or about how to get involved or like ways in which to make this information manageable and digestible. And maybe that's selfish. Maybe the information shouldn't be digestible or manageable because it's such a big issue and people just need to suck it up. But to someone like me or anyone listening who's maybe feeling overwhelmed by like the responsibility of individuals and the responsibility of the collective for getting involved in climate justice, what advice would you give?
Yeah, thanks, Piper. I think that's such a great question, and I'll try to do it justice, pardoning the pun. I guess, I mean, one place to start is to just honor that feeling of, you know, that it's overwhelming and other feelings that come along. Because those are totally like reasonable feelings. It is overwhelming. I mean, I can tell you it's as having sort of spent 20-ish years kind of in this space, that's been a consistent, you know, set. That's a familiar feeling for me. I think anybody who, you know, wherever they are in their climate journey, is going to wrestle with those types of feelings and others. And so that's like one part of the answer is actually to honor that. And there are some great folks who've done really great work around honoring that. There's a great book called Generation Dread, by Britt Ray, I think is her name, that I haven't read, but it's on my reading list and it looks great. And she's got great Twitter content. So I think it's probably great that dives into these themes. There's a psychologist, Margaret Klein Solomon, who's written a book called, and now I'm going to remember the author, but not the name of the book, but, you know, it's about this. It's about how do we wrestle with these feelings that come up in the face of things that are kind of big, like bigger than our cognition allows us to fathom. That's part of the challenge here. So, you know, it's totally okay and reasonable to feel overwhelmed. And I think there's a lot of value in sort of, yeah, sitting with that, acknowledging that feeling, you know, leaning into it, giving it space, because then you're allowing yourself kind of like a real and embodied response to what's actually happening. I think there's often this temptation to be like, well, I don't want to feel like I can't feel like that. I just need to be, I don't know. I just need to like move beyond that and then get it and then be doing all of this climate stuff. And it's like, well, the climate stuff is like, this is part of the climate stuff. It's wrestling with these feelings and it's other feelings too. Loss, grief, fear, anger, frustration, you know, are all sort of part and parcel, because, you know, the pandemic now gives us a bit of an experiential blueprint for this as well, of living through collective trauma, living through collective discontinuity. And that framing of discontinuity is, you know, one of the best that I have for this as well. I borrow that from a guy named Alex Steffen. So that's part of my answer of like, where do you start, right? And then another, something that's a bit more maybe tactical for lawyers in particular, for the legal community in particular, is that, well, you know, lawyers are risk professionals. That's what we do. We think about risks all day, every day for our clients, and you know, whether our clients are individuals or businesses or you know, what have you. That's what we're trained to do. That's what we're good at. That's what we pride ourselves on. It goes to the sort of center of our corporate, of our competency. And so to just frame this as, well, this is just a new lens, a new dimension on risk. And it's a dimension of risk that interacts with all of the other dimensions of risks. And that's what is sort of complicated about it, but also really interesting. And if you can find the opportunities to sort of engage your intellectual curiosity and just get curious about something, you know, you don't need to go out and become a climate scientist, you know, and start sort of, you know, mapping how aerosols move around the world, or, you know, you don't need to, it's impossible to learn everything. It is inherently sort of an interdisciplinary area of study. And so to just find something that's interesting to you, I think, you know, I haven't practiced family law. I don't really know anything about family law, but I think about family law as an interesting example. I could come up with hypotheticals where there's some sort of custody dispute, and there's, you know, the one parent wants to move, you know, away from an area of the country that is increasingly prone to catastrophic wildfires every year, with tons of wildfire smoke and hazardous breathing, and, you know, as we've seen in the West Coast, even you know, mass death. You know, 600 people died in BC a couple years ago from heat. Right, one parent wants to move away from all of that. The other parent wants to stay. Well, what are the best interests of the child in that context? How does the court wrestle with, you know, this family law notion of the best interests of the child? I have no idea. And there may already be case law on this because it's been moving so quickly. But I think, you know, if I were a family lawyer, that seems like a really interesting question. You know, corporate law, obviously, it's, you know, fiduciary duties, you know, lots of well-worn stuff there. Criminal law, I think criminal defense lawyers will be making all sorts of interesting constitutional arguments related to climate change, particularly in the context of detention and custody, and you know, the vulnerability or preparedness or, you know, ruggedness of different you know, facilities and conditions under which people might be detained and held by the state. That's interesting. We've seen certainly how that can get ugly in places like Texas when they had a big winter freeze a couple of years ago. And I know they've, you know, gone through things since. So there may be more recent examples of this. I just haven't gone looking for them, but I went looking for them a couple of years ago and they weren't hard to find. You know, prisons, inmates freezing, right? Without, you know, unable to keep warm, without sufficient supplies or provisions, with, you know, supply chains getting disrupted, you know, going without food, plumbing breaking down, you know, toilets overflowing, like really inhumane conditions, including, you know, for people who were just held pending trial, weren't even convicted of anything yet. I mean, that seems like an interesting problem as a criminal defense lawyer, right? Again, it's not an area that I practice in, but so I think there's lots for lawyers in different areas to sort of hang their hats on and say, you know, how might a destabilized climate and a climate that is, it's not just destabilized, but it's undergoing accelerating destabilization. It's one of the things that's hard to wrap your mind around, but it is really important. the change that we're seeing is speeding up. So how does accelerating destabilization affect my practice, my clients' interests, the types of disputes that they're already getting into? That's totally in our wheelhouse as lawyers to ask those types of questions. And then one more thing, you know, sort of tactically, is there is a growing amount of, you know, good professional, you know, education available for folks to start tapping into, to start learning this stuff. You know, there's definitely lots of books you can pick up and stuff. But there's also folks like there's a company called Inside Practice that puts on great events for the legal community. I'm speaking at a conference later this month on legal futures. It's a good forum for these types of conversations. There are also credentials like the something called the Global Association of Risk Professionals. They've offered a lot of professional education over the years for folks in finance and the energy industry. And they also have a good program now in sustainability and climate risk. So, you know, for folks who want to do a deeper dive and really sort of do the climate risk 101, get a bit of the science and the policy and all of that, you can do that. But really, I think the best thing is just to honor the feelings, start where you are, you know, find something that you care about or that you're interested in. Don't feel like you need to, you know, go become some sort of weird climate person now or become some, you know, deep domain expert overnight, because it's just not possible. And even as somebody who's been working, you know, working in the space for 20 years, you know, quote unquote, like I'm always at day one. Things are just changing so quickly and moving so quickly. There's always, always, always more to learn, which is a big challenge and can be overwhelming, but can also be endlessly fascinating. And the thing that, you know, one of the big things that really drew me into climate work in the first place is just how endlessly fascinating it is, because it touches every dimension of our lives. So, you know, if you're just somebody who's like, I love chocolate, you know, there's a climate story for you, right? If you love skiing, there's a climate angle for you. If, you know, whatever it is that you're interested in, whatever kind of business you're in, there's something for you to get interested and excited about in climate work.
That is a really excellent way to think about it and sort of contextualize it and see how the climate interacts with your day-to-day life, and sort of use that as a starting off point or a jumping off point to learn a bit more. So thanks for bringing up some of those considerations, because some of those things you just don't even think about when you're not dealing with it every day, but it's very interesting to see how things are going to start evolving. And sometimes it's really easy to think, oh yes, that's an issue for the future. But like you said, these issues are already coming into play and touching the law in many different ways, not just the traditional sense, like even the family law and criminal law context that you were bringing up. But just to switch gears a little bit here, what was the catalyst to pursuing your certified executive coaching program? And how has the certification changed your approach to your legal practice?
Yeah, I love that question. Thanks. I'll try to be brief, which I feel like I'm doing a terrible job at today. But so as part of this sort of, you know, burnout recovery, you know, reinvention, who am I? What am I doing? What do I actually want my life and career to look like coming out of my articles? I had it in my mind. Well, first I thought, okay, so I need to be intentional. I need to really design this and imagine, what do I actually want my days and my weeks to look like? You know, what kind of impact do I want to have? What types of, you know, who am I interacting with? What kind of conversations am I having? What, you know, just what am I actually doing? And so that led me to think, well, you know, I want to be happy. I want to be joyful. I want to be well. I want to have energy as part of that. And I'm really not in that place, you know, now. And that was back in 2020, super burnt out, chronic pain, not sleeping, nerves were shot, couldn't think straight. You know, so I didn't want to keep feeling like that. And I thought, well, what if I got as curious about personal development and wellness and personal growth, and that whole sort of process as I have about other things in the past? What if I sort of made it, you know, a passion and a project and an area of, you know, an area for the slow pursuit of mastery, as I might and as I have approached, you know, things that I've studied in school, or you know, with the same sort of determination that I've prioritized, you know, work, career projects in the past. What if I prioritized myself in the same way, my wellness, my growth, and made that the center, you know, like the thing around which I build my, the rest of my life and career? How cool is that? So these were the types of things I was sort of asking myself and trying to give myself permission to think in 2020. And as part of that imagining, I thought, well, yeah, cool. How cool would it be to get into coaching? But in like 5 or 10 years, right? Like after I've, you know, really legitimized myself and I've done all of this other stuff, and, you know, I don't want to be, you know, I think I really had it in my mind still that I had to prove myself as a lawyer. I had to like stick that out for a while. And I was so close to the Artic Lang and law school experience still. It was, you know, there's been a lot of work to sort of disentangle some of those things. So, it, you know, anyway, it entered my mind early in sort of mid 2020 or fall 2020, but I thought it was going to be a long-term thing. And then I started having more and more, you know, mentorship conversations with people. One of the great things about the legal industry, I think, is our culture of, you know, mentorship. And so I was trying to be of support and service to other folks, law students and Artic Lang students, you know, who were going through, you know, different choices and difficult things. And I started getting some really nice feedback, like, oh, hey, you know, Aladdin, have you ever thought about doing this? You know, this is so helpful. One person told me at one point, you know, oh, you people would pay a lot of money for the support and the advice and the, you know, the help and the questions that you're asking and so on. So that was that's nice to hear. But I kind of brushed those things off for a while. And I helped some other, you know, I helped a few friends make some big job and life transitions. And, you know, so these types of things were going on, but I was brushing off the feedback for a while because I think I didn't want to be ego driven about it. I wanted to make sure that if I was going to get into coaching, it was going to be for the right reasons, and that I actually had some sense that I knew what I was doing and was able to offer real value to people. And I felt like, who am I to do this? And it'll be so cringy and embarrassing, you know, start calling myself a coach, like, ugh, don't want to be that guy. So there was a lot of those sort of beliefs and voices in the background. And then I had another one of these conversations about a year ago with another good friend of mine, a former colleague of mine. And she was wanting to, you know, do a bunch of creative stuff alongside her legal practice, including start a podcast and some other things. And we were having a chat, and I was, you know, just very sort of encouraging and inviting her to think about those types of projects, not as like a 5-year type of thing, which was how she was describing them, but as, well, what, you know, what if you just could make, you know, space for that in your life now? You're saying how that's ultimately what you really want to be doing, and it would be so joyful, and it's, you know, like, if that's the end goal anyway, why not just try to do it now? And so that was like a great conversation. She was all happy. She sent me a really nice email afterwards, again, telling me, you know, you should really consider doing this. And then I thought, well, I guess I have to kind of take my own advice here, right? Like, if I'm telling myself that what I really want to be doing is having great conversations with, you know, with great people you know, trying to be of help in that way, that's what I really enjoy, that's the impact that I want to have, why am I putting that off? Why not try to, you know, see how I can fit that into my life now? And so, as often happens, I changed my perspective, and then I started to see new opportunities. And so I asked, you know, what would it take? What would it look like if I tried to make this happen in the next, you know, 5 months? And found a great program that I really liked the look of, found some clients who were interested in paying me, which, you know, allowed me to sort of self-fund the program to a degree, which is very helpful. And And I was sort of off to the races. And so now in my collection of hats, one more hat to wear, I find myself with a coaching practice. As for how it's sort of affected my legal practice, it's been, you know, tremendously valuable. I think I ask better questions. I listen better. I have a sense of how to guide people through their own thinking in a bit of a structured way, also in an intuitive way. Very helpful for client conversations and for sort of thinking through legal strategy or business strategy, which I do a lot of in my law practice. I'm a corporate lawyer, work with small and medium-sized businesses who are trying to have impact. So lots of interesting conversations, and coaching skill set is great for that. And it's also helped internally with the firm. I think I work better with the other lawyers that I practice in association with. It's been good for the growth of that business. So it's been very rich in a very short period of time. And I'm kind of excited to see, how I carry it with me going forward. It feels pretty evergreen.
That's so amazing, Aladdin. I know that you're growing your practice and that you're like thinking about the ways that you can use your powers for good, so to speak. Use your skills for good. And I think that it's really cool to watch you bloom and like find new pathways to use these skills. And I think that it's so valuable because you talk about doing work that's like not ego-driven. And I think that that's so important for everyone to reflect on, especially in our profession. And I think that that's really important. And it's a really good question, like in general in life, to ask yourself, like, why am I doing this? Like, what is driving me to do this? Who am I trying to like make happy and make whole in this moment and with this new pathway or with this decision? So that really resonates. So Aladdin, I was wondering now if you could tell us a little bit about, you talked about how your own burnout was a catalyst for, you know, some of the decisions you've made in your career. And so many professionals of all generations, I think sometimes, like, maybe I'm overgeneralizing, sometimes now we talk about burnout and we think about, you know, elder millennials and millennials, but burnout is affecting everyone at scary, scary, scary rates. And I am not a psychologist, a psychiatrist, or a historian, so I feel like I'm about to make sweeping generalizations right now, but I don't know if this was happening in previous generations or happening in the same way. And so what advice would you give to someone struggling with burnout and trying to manage themselves as a whole person and their career?
Yeah. I just want to say, like, I so deeply appreciate that both of you are creating so much space for these types of questions and conversations as well. I think it's invaluable, and I would have found so much benefit, you know, finding and listening to your podcast, you know, basically at any point in my legal journey from when I was first thinking about applying to law school. It would have been very helpful back then. And you know, at any point along the way through law school, through articling and into my practice, I think that question that you're asking, you know, what is going on and how do we deal with this is really important and really powerful. So obviously I'm not a historian or a mental health professional of any kind either. But I'm also willing to sort of speculate and make sweeping generalizations. It's kind of my favorite thing, one of my favorite things to do. So, you know, as far as, you know, who have people gone through this before? And, you know, I have two sort of hot takes on that. One being, for sure people have gone through great burnout and everything that's sort of associated with that before. And it may have looked different. They may have had different coping strategies than the coping strategies that, you know, we're trying, you know, that we're looking for. Whether that's, you know, the way that their relationships ended up going, or their relationship with, drugs or alcohol or, you know, other sort of lifestyle pieces, or just the sort of trajectory, the life trajectory of their health, or you know, the way that they are, you know, regulating and managing their emotions. I think if we look at our elders, you know, from the generation before us, or our parents' generation, or our grandparents' generation, it's not difficult to find examples of people who've lived with great chronic stress and exhaustion, and bear the cost of that in some form or another. And I think that's part of my answer, is that there's always a cost. It just sometimes looks different. I also, you know, as a late diagnosed ADHD, or you know, I sort of bring that neurodivergence lens to the conversation as well, and to the burnout conversation in particular. I didn't start to even entertain the idea that I might have ADHD until I was, you know, toward the end of my second year of law school. And I look back over the career that I've had, the life that I've had, and cycles of burnout that I've gone through, I think, well, yeah, you know, this latent undiagnosed neurodivergence is such a big part of that. And again, if we look at our elders, you know, I think those examples are abound as well. It's easy to see people who've lived even longer with undiagnosed neurodivergence, without self-awareness, without self-compassion, without tools and frameworks, community support necessarily, to manage their relationship with that in a compassionate way, to self-regulate in a compassionate way, or to, you know, manage and have space in their life for their dysregulation in a compassionate way. And so their life ends up being dysregulated in different ways again. So that's part of my answer, right? Is yes, people have been through it. And sometimes it looks different. And I think a big part of the story of you know, the conversations like this that I have with people is we want to make different choices. We don't want to make those same trade-offs. I don't want to have to, you know, to be quote unquote success, you know, I mean, it's just ridiculous, right? To be successful in law. Now, making a fraction of the inflation adjusted salary that somebody did even 10 years ago, let alone 20 or 30. And now in a context where, and also because of my, you know, cost of living and law school costs and everything else, is the way it is. And, you know, because of who my partner is, like, there's one of us isn't going to stay home and just and support the other as a full-time job while the other person is going and working 10, 12, 14 hours a day, and have those things be our careers. Our careers are both out of the house. And I think if you look at that, you know, so much of, again, this is going to be one of my big sweeping statements, but so much of the sort of culture of what the law profession is, and the dysfunction of the law profession that we've inherited and that we're bucking against and struggling with, is the product of a very particular set of, you know, sort of circumstances. And it's been shaped, I think, to a large degree by a generation of, or a couple generations of men who had their wives staying at home, supporting them to do this crazy job and bearing a lot of the costs of that. And that model doesn't work anymore for a bajillion reasons, and we don't want it, right? By and large, like, a lot of us just don't want anything to do with that. So that's valid, right? Like, we're allowed to say, I don't want to, you know, I want to have a relationship with my partner. I want to come home and not be drained of energy and exhausted and, you know, angry and whatever else, right? I want to see my, you know, if I had kids, like, I want to see my kids. And it's also fine to, you know, be a working professional, and right, like, we're trying to balance a lot of things. We're really trying to have it all in a way. So that's tough. I'm losing my train of thought a little bit here, but the other place that I wanted to go with this, setting those sort of grand sweeping statements aside, is that as much as other generations have dealt with their own sort of burnout and those challenges, and, you know, maybe borne those costs in different ways, and I try to be really compassionate about that too, because this, you know, we're able to have these conversations very openly now. Like, we are in the process of changing the culture, and that's important work. And we're creating more support for ourselves in the process of doing that. The support wasn't always there. So, but we, you know, we also want to make different choices. We don't want to, you know, we don't necessarily want things to go the way that they've gone for some elders that we may have in our lives. With all of that being said, I think it's also true, and this brings back in the climate conversation, right? That we have, like, we really are under a lot of pressure. We are not just, you know, professionals in a tough profession with rising, you know, living costs and rising costs of rising debt loads and all of that. We're also living in this context of broader discontinuity, you know, whether it's the accelerating climate destabilization, or it's all of the other layers of planetary crisis that fit together with that, soil loss and, overfishing and the pollution crisis, plastic pollution, and all of these other pieces. That's a lot that's like in the background. We try to just like, it's okay, I'm gonna be a professional, and just, you know, we're trying to, looking around and like, is anybody else freaking out? No. Okay. It must be okay. Right. Okay. Keep going. Like, it's all normal, and it's super not normal. Right. Now, yes, people have lived through great, huge crises, discontinuities before, calamities, war, natural disasters, and so on. But the context that we're in now is one in which, I would argue those things are now the normal. They're not localized, they're globalized. And it's accelerating. We've entered a qualitatively new era. So, you know, that's going to lead to some burnout too, especially trying to like, you know, keep our ties all buttoned up and keep acting like it's all super normal, because it's not. We are in a qualitatively new era. What is it, you know, so what does it mean to be a professional in that context? What does it mean to be, a competent lawyer in that context? What does it mean to find wellness in the context of such rapid change, discontinuity? It's a tough question. And this another theme that I've, you know, been really thinking about and wrestling with a lot the last couple of years, and I think is really interesting and exciting. And this idea that our personal crises and our collective crises are not separate. They're actually deeply, deeply connected. And so, for example, in, you know, deciding to center your own wellness, your own relationship with yourself and your life, to have a compassionate, healthy practice with yourself, that affects your other relationships. It affects your relationships with your friends, your family, your, you know, romantic partners, with the people that you do business with how you show up in those business relationships, the culture that you create in the organizations that you're working in, and more broadly through our community. And so this sort of, lining up of how does my personal wellness relate to our collective wellness? How do the personal challenges that I've gone through relate to the collective challenges that we're going through? And how can I, in working on one little piece of that somewhere, in this sort of complex, magical way, actually have an impact on the whole as well.
I think that made sense. No, that was great. Thank you so much for summarizing very eloquently all of the different levels and nuances and things that have kind of been bubbling around the surface. I know at least I feel that too sometimes, where you're in your own bubble and you feel like everything's out of control, and you look around and everything else is also out of control, and you're just like, is anyone else feeling this? Is anyone else noticing this? And especially in the digital era, sometimes it can feel very isolating. So thanks very much for taking the time to sort of lay that out and explain that for us. And great food for thought. But we have so enjoyed speaking with you on the podcast today. But we like to end our podcast with the same question every time, which is, what is something new that you've learned recently?
So I love that question, and I have a great answer, and it's much lighter than any of this, you know, my sort of rambling thoughts so far. It's been awesome to be on. So thank you for having me. I really appreciate the chance to talk. And I just love what you're creating and putting into this, the world with this podcast. So something I've learned recently is how to make sort of a Japanese style breakfast salmon, which I love. If you've ever had like a sort of traditional-ish Japanese breakfast, it's very, you know, it's not uncommon to have some fish and, you know, rice, maybe some miso soup or something, salted salmon. It's so simple. And I just never had any notion of how to make it before. And now I do. So you just take a couple of tablespoons of salt and a tablespoon of sugar, and you dissolve that into about a cup of water, and you slice up some salmon into types of, you know, size of pieces that you might like to eat, and you marinate that for about 7 to 12 hours. Overnight is fine. You can leave it in there longer. It just gets saltier and more delicious. Take it out, dry it off, and throw it in, you know, a toaster oven or in the oven under a broiler, or you can do it in a pan as well. A little bit of rice and you know, fresh veg. It sounds like a really, I don't know, maybe people don't want to eat fish for breakfast, but I love it. It's like my favorite new thing. So that's something I learned recently.
I've heard about like hyperfixation meals, like where you just like find something and you want to eat it like over and over and over and over and over again. And so I can totally relate to that. Like you just find something like new and delicious and you're like, I need this in my life every day for the next 3 months, and then you potentially
abandon it for years.
Abandon it for a long time and then repeat the cycle in a couple of years. Exactly. Aladdin, this has been such a joy. We have been so looking forward to recording this episode with you, and we are so excited that it is now out in the world. Thank you for sharing your perspectives with us, and we truly, truly cannot wait to see how your career continues to evolve. I know it will be nothing short of rewarding, both for you and the communities you impact and the planet and just the world. You have so much goodness to give, and we're just so happy that you shared some of it with us here today. So thank you so much.
Well, that is incredibly generous, Piper. I really, I really appreciate it. I feel the same way. It's been a delight. So thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us for this episode. To stay up to date with the podcast, follow us on Instagram at Off the Tracks Podcast. Be sure to subscribe on your favorite listening platform for a brand new episode of Off the Tracks Podcast every Tuesday.